I promised at this point was some solutions. And so let me see what I need on the board. And what I can erase. But let me erase that and work here and there. And this this is going to be repetition, the first part from the early part of the class, the one of the first meetings. But now maybe I put in context. So let me first describe self-dual solutions. The cosmological not zero. And then I'll describe self-dual solutions, the cosmological constant being zero. Now, the idea is that this object here, I called previously JABK. And self-dual solutions with the cosmological constant not zero are solutions to J equals zero. So that F is proportional to E, and the constant of proportionality is a cosmological constant. This is consistent, if you remember, the equations of motion. If we went back to the form with, let me go back to the form with the action, I'm just writing it schematically, with like sigma wedge F plus or minus the cosmological constant times sigma wedge sigma minus this constraint phi ij sigma wedge sigma. And this gets incorporated into this with the constraint that the trace of phi is proportional to the cosmological constant. And then the equation of motion said that F is equal, Fi as a two-form in space-time is equal to phi ij sigma j. And let me notice that this j equals zero is the pullback of the solution when phi is just diagonal and it just has the cosmological constant on the diagonal. In which case, if you pull this back to the three surface, so these are two forms in space-time, but if you pull them back to the three surface, they become two forms in the spatial manifold, and it says that F is equal to lambda times E, okay, which I got a sign wrong somewhere. But so there's some sign wrong, but you see the point. So this was the space-time equations of motion. And I can get here from any of the forms of the action principle, but that form is very convenient to show this. So if F is, as I showed before, if J is 0, C is 0, this is 0, because DE is related to D of F, 0 by the Young's identity, and this is 0 as well, because E into F is related to E into E with an epsilon, which anti-symmetrizes and gives zero. So J equals zero implies, let me put it here, implies all the constraints are zero. G equals D equals C equals zero. So we get immediately self-dual solutions to the Einstein equations with cosmological constant. And I won't repeat the discussion before, but among the self-dual Euclidean solutions is the four-sphere, which is with cosmological constant positive, which is the Euclidean de Sitter spacetime, which is the four-sphere. And I showed that in some detail before. In the Euclidean case, this is not the only solution. There's a whole classification of solutions. Okay. In the Lorentzian case, the de Sitter or the anti-de-Sitter spacetime is the unique self-dual solution, and I'll explain why when we come to the Lorentzian case. Okay, now, what about, here's just a little vignette, what about lambda equals zero? Well, if lambda equals zero, we want to solve these equations. In that case, see, the difference between them is that lambda equals, in the case of lambda equals not zero, if you go back, that says that the Ricci is related to some amount of lambda times g, and the Ricci is not zero. So the curvature tensor has a piece which is vial and a piece which is Ricci, which is related to the metric. I keep looking for my eraser, but there it is. In the case of zero cosmological constant, Ricci is zero. And what's relevant here is that F is related to the left-handed part, in general, of the Riemann curvature. So in the case of lambda not zero, the Riemann curvature has in it a piece which is Ricci, and this left-handed curvature has a piece which is Ricci, which is related to the cosmological constant times the metric, and that's what this says, J equals zero. What this says is that the left-handed part of the Riemann curvature is a piece related to the metric times the cosmological constant, which you can also just get directly from the decomposition of Riemann into Weyl, Ricci, and so forth. Okay. So the point is that when the cosmological constant is not zero, the left-handed part of Riemann is different from the left-handed part of Weyl. When the cosmological constant is zero, Riemann is Weyl. Maybe I just spelled that out. Riemann is Weyl, and therefore the left-handed part of Riemann is the left-handed part of Weyl. And self-dual means, in this context, that the left-handed part of Weyl vanishes, so that the curvature is purely the right-handed part of Weyl. So if we want to express, and this is equal to F, so this is equal to zero. That's what we mean in the absence of a cosmological constant. When Riemann is purely Weyl, the F, which is the left-handed part of Riemann, is the left-handed part of Weyl. And what we mean by self-dual is that the left-handed part of Weyl vanishes, so that the curvature is entirely in the right-handed part of Weyl. And this is an interesting case because F equals zero. And F equals zero suggests we should be able to choose a gauge locally where A is equal to zero. I'm not going to worry about topological non-triviality. So A is equal to zero. Okay. So what happens to our constraints and our equations of motion? And there's a little cool thing that happens here. Okay. Let's just look at it. Here are our constraints. So there's no cosmological constant. F is zero, so that's satisfied. F is zero, so that's satisfied. So you're just this, and this is just the ordinary derivative. So all A is zero, so we just have the three vector fields, vector densities, E, A, I. Okay. And Gauss's law just says that they're divergence-free, each of them. And it just acts separately on them. It just says there are three divergence-free vector fields. Okay. Now, what about the equations of motion? Here are the equations of motion. I forgot to write the cosmological constant. Is there? Okay. So what about A dot This is zero because there's no cosmological constant. This is zero, so F is zero, so A dot is zero. So it is preserved. F is zero is preserved under evolution. You start with the left-handed part of the Weyl tensor zero, it stays zero. This A zero stays zero. And what's E dot? E dot is just given by this little thing with no A. So all that we're left with is E dot I is epsilon I J K, E dot A I, del B, E A I, E, sorry, E J, E D I. Just that. So with an N snuck in there. Okay, so you just have a theory of three vector densities, which are divergence free, which transform to among each other in a nice way. Okay, can anybody see how to further simplify that? Okay, let me I realize I forgot to actually check this, and this is like 15 years ago. But there's just one equation to check. So let me tell you what it is. And then something very interesting happens. So I want to get rid of these densities. So let me get rid of these densities. And I just have one thing to do to get rid of the densities. I have this inverse lattice. So let me define a vector field, VA, which is the inverse lattice times the vector density, EA. And I do this for each one of them. And let me consider a gauge where the lattice is constant. So I can stiff it in and out of derivatives. And the lattice is an inverse density, so saying that it's constant is not so much a condition on the density, it's fixing a gauge on the coordinates. So in those coordinates, I have just each of the three vector fields is divergence free. And if you play with this, this is what I forgot to check, but I can leave it to you to check. This says something very cute. It says V dot AI is epsilon IJK times the commutator of VJ and VK. So you have three in this coordinate, once in the gauge fixed system, you have three vector fields. Okay? And the time root of any one is the commutator of the other two, and they're divergence free. And that's the self-dual Einstein equation. And I think that's cool. Now, I should say that some mathematicians or mathematical physicists, Lionel Mason, Ted Newman, and then a series of papers, have used this to argue for integrability of the self-dual Einstein equations. There's actually, you can go places with this formulation. I can't, but a mathematician can go places with this. They end up sort of arguing, if you know what the words mean, that the self-dual Einstein equations are the same thing as a chiral theory, a sort of chiral nonlinear signal model theory, where the algebra is the diffeomorphism group. But anyway, this This was astonishingly simple. But it turned out to lead to a whole development of how to think about and decompose the subdual Einstein equations. And the reason why I'm showing it to you is to show you that right away from the algebra formulation, you get, even at the level of classical geometry, you get payoffs. That is both the self-dual with cosmological constant, the self-dual without cosmological constant, look very simple. Okay. Questions? I want to talk about boundaries, and I want to talk about going back to the Lorentzian theory. Let me talk about boundaries first. And by the way, what I'm trying to do in this session is set you up so that in the next session we're going to be quantizing this theory. So, and let me think about what I need from where. Okay, I don't need this for the boundaries. Sorry for all the noise. Should I turn the mic down? Is that too loud? I realize that we're hearing you, right? Okay. There are several different versions of the theory, of the boundary theory. And let me first do sort of ADM, recover ADM boundary conditions. And for this, the best reference is either of Abai's books. And does anybody have one, or does anybody know if our library? You have. Is it that our libraries, or?
I have his first one from 1990.
Oh, good. Okay. Yeah, I think our library has both. Okay. But in any case, if you want to see the details of this. That's the works and papers, but that's the best place. And by the way, if you want to know anything about asymptotic conditions, boundary conditions, and general relativity generally, there's usually a Abai, before he did all this stuff, that was something that he had contributed a lot to, and he's sort of the master of the subtleties of boundary conditions. Okay. So, and indeed, it's subtle, and I hope I get it roughly right. And the subtlety is the following. We would like to say something like, there is a coordinate on the spatial manifold called R. So now, the spatial manifold is R3. You can do this just with something that looks asymptotically R3, but I'm not going to do that. And you have some flat metric Q0 AB, which you can put just on R3. And you want to express the condition that as R goes to infinity, the 3 geometry goes to Q0 AB plus terms of order 1 over R. And the subtlety is that when I've said that, I've broken the amorphous invariance. Asymptotically. And the reason why I've broken diffeomorphism invariance is that there are different flat metrics up to diffeomorphisms. That is, there is one flat Euclidean geometry mod diffeomorphisms, but when you consider things not equivalent under diffeomorphisms, there are actually different flat metrics, which are related to each other under diffeomorphisms. And to say we pick a flat metric breaks diffeomorphisms. And to say, to put on an asymptotic condition like this breaks diffeomorphism invariance asymptotically. Because R is a coordinate which is, what I mean by R is distance in Q0. That is, in other words, there are some coordinates where Q starts off, where Q0 looks like ds squared is dr squared plus r squared d omega squared, where this R is the R that we're going to use to fall off. So that, the statement of the selection of Q0 breaks diffeomorphism invariance everywhere. And the subtlety is that because you require Q to go to Q0 plus terms of order 1 over R, where R is defined in terms of Q0, you also break diffeomorphisms up to terms of order 1 over R. And what this means is that you preserve. So let me give this condition a name, say G-clef. You preserve G-clef if V itself, the vector field in the generator diffeomorphisms itself, is order 1 over R squared. But 1 over R squared will do it. There are subtleties about 1 over R that I don't want to mess with. So I'm going to be generous and say 1 over R squared. Okay. So what I mean by that is that, and now I'm using the three geometry. We'll translate back into Astigar variables in a minute. The variation of a metric under variation by a vector field is the lead derivative of the metric, which is del A VB plus del B VA. And if we want the condition that to order 0 and 1 over R, we preserve this condition, you can check that that requires that V fall at 1 over R squared. That is, in that measured in these coordinates, the components measured in these coordinates, where Q0 has this spherically symmetric nice flat form, fall at 1 over R squared. But that preserves the condition. Okay. Now, what that implies is that, as well, when we go to the Astigar coordinates, to the Astigar variables, well, let me, that implies if we that the E, so given the Q0, there's an E0, which is the frame field that you make such that it gives that free metric and it's densitized. And so E is E0A. And I'll come back to an issue about ordering gate transformations in a second. This also plus order 1 over R. And A goes like terms of 1 over R squared as well, roughly speaking, because A has in it derivatives of the metric. So if the metric is like 1 over r, either the connection or its time derivative goes like 1 over r squared. And there's no a0 because the left-handed flat connection is 0. So this is, I should say, I'm doing all of this at 0 cosmological constant. Asymptotically, the sitter, asymptotically, ADS is different from what I'm doing. Now, with these conditions, then let me just point and maybe check. I'll just write down. With these conditions, then C, there are no boundary conditions that come into the generator of diffeomorphisms D. So with these conditions, that is where I consider D of V equals integral of V against D, where V is falling off like 1 over r squared at infinity. And in fact, what I'm about to say is true if it falls off like 1 over r, then this, first of all, converges. So the integral is well defined. Now we have infinite integrals, so we have to worry about who converges and who doesn't. And the algebra closes, that is, d of w is d of commutator of v and w. Okay. Even to being careful about the integration by parts that I was dropping before. So you were asking me about dropping integration by parts, and the point is that one way to deal with the integration by parts is to insist on fall-off conditions. And what this does is I'm saying that we only do diffeomorphisms which fall fast enough at infinity that there's no integration by parts issue in the action or the algebra of diffeomorphisms. So that the diffeomorphisms leave the asymptotic conditions in terms of a fixed three, flat three metric, fixed and frozen. And therefore, we have still an algebra of diffeomorphisms, but an algebra of diffeomorphisms that fall off fast enough that there's no bound, the diffeomorphisms don't touch anything, quote, at the boundary. And there are fancy ways of saying this in terms of conformal boundaries and so forth, but in my experience, it's not helpful because it's, you know, when you try to implement these things quantum mechanically, you have enough subtleties to worry about without having gone to some conformally related metric where things are blowing up at the boundary. So is it clear? And I'm sketching here. That is, you should go through and count and see that inside D is E and F is falling off like 1 over R cubed. E is going to a constant. And check that everybody's behaving nicely enough that with V falling off, and in fact, V can just fall off like 1 over R is good enough for these things. That first, the integral is finite. And secondly, there's no boundary term, the integration by parts term that comes into the algebra. Okay. And similarly, and here I don't remember what the fall-off condition is, but similarly, with lambda, the gauge parameter, I'm going to say 1 over r, which is what I think it is. It's also true that g of lambda is convergent. And the algebra closes. And that tells us something very important, which is that we're fixing the gauge, the SU2 gauge asymptotically. There's a preferred E0. Remember, the E's refer to some frame field. These are density times frame field, and the SU2 transformations rotate the gauge field, And we're saying that those transformations of the rotated gauge field are falling off as we go to infinity. So there's a fixed E0 at infinity, and therefore fixed gauge. We fix the SU2 gauge at infinity. Okay. And these are all things to be checked and thought through. Now I come to the meat of the issue. Which is, what do we do about the Hamiltonian constraint? So what do I do now with the Hamiltonian constraint? And in particular, if we now stare at these evolution equations, in this one, there's an integration by parts. And let's just keep that in mind. I threw away an integration by parts there, which we want to think about. It's a subtlety that we want to think about. What are the fallout conditions on N in C of N? Now remember that our picture, roughly speaking, is that N is the lapse. It tells us how far we're pushing ahead the slices. And remember that the Hamiltonian is just a linear combination of constraints. There's the Hamiltonian vanishes. Now, what happens to these? And roughly speaking, the picture is that locally, so say I can consider evolving by an N which just has compact support in some region, and this just changes the value of the fields on this slice to the value of the fields on this slice, and this has a double interpretation. If I fix the time for the time function and fix the slicing, and I evolve from this slicing to this slicing, or from this slicing to this slicing, I've evolved the fields in that time function that I fixed. But there's another interpretation, which is equally valid, which is what I've done is changed the gauge, that has changed the time function, so that whereas this was a surface of constant time function, now this is a surface of constant time function. And the value of the fields changing from here to here can be seen as a gauge transformation. And because the Hamiltonian vanishes and is just proportional to constraints, and because these are constraints, both interpretations are true, classically. That is, if I think of the time function as fixed, or if I added to the theory some gauge condition, which would, just let me finish the sentence, that would be fixing the time function, then these equations are evolution. Okay. Conversely, I can see them as change of the fields under gauge, where I've changed the time function, and I can think of that as a gauge transformation. Yes?
So it's just very naive, not using the question.
I'm sure it's not.
Well, what happens if you have like a universe where you have matter everywhere?
Matter what?
Everywhere.
Yes. Like,
because that picture assumes, you know, you have your...
Oh, the fallout conditions?
Yeah.
No, the fallout conditions, if there's matter, then there are fallout conditions on the matter, and you don't have matter near infinity.
Yeah, but if we have...
Then a universe with matter everywhere cannot be asymptotically flat.
Yes.
Yes. So this does not apply.
Okay.
Okay, this is a class of solutions or class of problems where definitely, I don't, now there are subtleties, but let's just, we don't have any matter yet, okay?
Yeah.
But let's just imagine that matter is confined to some compact region.
Yeah.
Okay, like a star or a galaxy or something.
In our universe,
I agree. I agree. Okay, and therefore, this class of problems, okay, there is a disjunction in general relativity, in general, between problems of isolated systems, where one imposes boundary conditions to model what we mean by an isolated system, and cosmological problems where we try to model the whole universe, which obviously, at least I can't imagine the universe has some asymptotically flat region or some boundary condition on it.
If you want to have a theory of quantum gravity for solving issues such as the Big Bang,
I know. Yes, no doubt. No doubt. And what I'm exploring at the moment is, are some, and these are no doubt sub-issues, but they're important issues, which is why I'm including them. What I'm about to do is something you can only do in an idealized case where you can impose such boundary conditions, which includes the idealization that there's some isolated system as far as the matter is concerned, and we just have vacuum space-time outside that.
Yeah, well, sorry, just for but then, in reality, typically, if you consider systems where you need quantum gravity, I mean, all kind of real objects which we can treat that way, like galaxies or stars, for those,
I don't completely agree, but the point is very well taken, and if you don't let me do this, then let me just finish the sentence as I was saying before, okay? If you don't let me add anything to the speech that I just gave, if this is a spatially compact region without any boundary conditions, okay, then I just asserted that you can't tell the difference locally between evolution and gauge. Okay, that's what I basically just said. I said as far as the effect on a local field, you can't tell whether I'm evolving it in a fixed time coordinate or changing the time coordinate. The effect on the local fields is the same. Okay. Therefore, if I'm to have a physically sensible observable, which is gauge invariant, if I really believe that these changes of slicings are gauge, it can't be a local function of the fields. And that's very interesting and a very important conclusion. Now, what the importance of the idealization of such asymptotically flat boundary conditions is that I'm breaking the gauge, I'm making the idealization that the gravitational field is very weak, far away from some region where it might be strong with matter or not, and I'm going to get some observables out at infinity which are cheaply gauge invariant, because I'm making the gauge transformations fall off fast enough that I get some cheap observables. Okay. But they're cheap observables, but they might be, they are certainly relevant for astronomical phenomena. And they are, for example, without such cheap observables as I'm in the process of introducing, you couldn't compute the energy radiated by a binary pulsar, which is something that's been compared to experiments of 10 and 12 or something decimal places. Okay, so you get, so very good. Please keep raising those issues. Okay. Now, the constraint, here's a criteria, okay? A constraint that is a generator of a gauge transformation should take local fields to local fields. Okay, this is a somewhat different way to say what I'm saying. What I mean by that is that delta of any local field under some Poisson bracket with constraints, I usually do that in the other order, so let me put a minus sign there, should be something else local. What it could not be is that plus, say, the derivative of some vector density, so that when I integrate it, I get a boundary. Or this is the constraint also at a point y. If I consider what I mean by, say, an integrated constraint, so some Lagrange multiplier, lambda, I'll just say it for Gauss's law, okay, times phi, would phi as any field. Okay. The worry is that I could get something local, okay, plus a boundary term, some integral on the boundary of the manifold of some stuff, because of integrating by parts. Because in here I have an integral. In the Poisson bracket I have to integrate by parts. So I could get a boundary term. And if I get a boundary term, then the gauge transformation of a local field in the space-time has a boundary term, which is bizarre. And would screw up the interpretation of this as a gauge transformation, because as a local gauge transformation, either making a local SU2 transformation or making a local Diffie morphism. So from the requirement that this not happen, from the requirement that there be no boundary conditions, okay, we get fall-off conditions. On the Lagrange multipliers. And this is an independent argument to tell you that V should fall off faster than 1 over R, it turns out. Lambda should fall off faster than, I think, 1 over... I don't remember what the power of lambda is. And it also, very importantly, tells you that N has to fall off, I believe, faster than 1 over r squared. Or at least as fast as 1 over r squared. That is, if you try to push the field forward and get its variation under changing the time coordinate, and the lapse was not falling off fast enough, then the time coordinate of some local field here would involve a boundary term. And that doesn't make sense as it being some response to a local change in the time coordinate or local diffeomorphism. So if something is to generate a gauge transformation, it has to, its Lagrange multipliers have to fall off sufficiently fast. Okay. And that includes the lapse. That includes the thing that multiplies the Hamiltonian constraint here. Okay. So that's nice, but that leaves us with the question, what if we want to push the time coordinate forward at infinity? That is, supposing that we are thinking about, we have this flat metric. Near infinity, the geometry is close to this flat metric. I can choose a time coordinate such that the space-time geometry is also flat. And what if I'm trying to discuss what an observer, an inertial observer near infinity, just sitting there in this flat metric, or approximately flat metric, sees? Okay, I want to push the fields forward by a time coordinate where I change the time coordinate. That is to say, more precisely, and let me give myself a board here. I think I don't need that board. Supposing that I fix a time coordinate, let me call it T, okay, near infinity. So that is the space-time metric. Now, there's now a space-time metric G0, and it corresponds to ds squared is minus d capital T squared plus dr squared plus r squared d omega squared. So now I also have a fixed time coordinate. And supposing I want to know how to evolve the fields in that fixed time coordinate. Well, that, since I know that the Einstein equations come from the constraint, I want to say something like the Hamiltonian is like an integral of n against the Hamiltonian constraint, where as r goes to infinity, n, this inverse lattice, goes to 1 over square root of the determinant of q, 0, which, by the way, is 1. So I'd like to choose an n which falls off nicely, not to 0, because if it falls off to 0, I can just change the slices locally, but I can't evolve, I can't match to some clock of an observer at infinity. If I want to match to some clock which measures some time coordinate in flat space-time near infinity, I need an n that falls off to 1. But then I run into this problem, that my n has to fall off to 0, otherwise I get boundary terms. And I'll get time derivatives of local derivatives of local fields that have boundary terms. So I have a contradiction. And the resolution of the contradiction is that what I'm trying to do is not a gauge transformation. Because I fixed the r coordinate near infinity, so I fixed the spatial diffeomorphism gauge, and I fixed the time coordinate near infinity, and what I'm doing when asking how the fields evolve according to a slicing which evolves according to some clock at infinity is not a gauge transformation. So, how do I implement it? Well, I have to avoid this issue. This issue of derivatives coming here. And there is an issue of derivatives in that equation there. That is, the C and N, if the N doesn't fall off fast enough, see the EE part falls off to a constant, which is related to the flat metric infinity. If the n goes to 1, if the derivative goes to an ordinary derivative, I have there a boundary term if I have integrated things against n. And it doesn't make sense to have such a boundary term. So what I have to do is make sure I don't get the boundary term. And to not get the boundary term, I have to subtract off a boundary term in the Hamiltonian. That is, to get sensible evolution in which local fields evolve locally, I have to add a boundary term to the Hamiltonian. And the boundary term that I have to put there has to be there. So I'm just going to give it a name for a moment. I'm just going to call it B. It's a density on the boundary, which we can take to be some two-dimensional surface, a two-dimensional sphere. Okay. And I need to put something here that will cancel when I take E dot, that will cancel that term, which is EE. Okay. So what is B? B, you can work out what B is, and it is EA. So I need some nomenclature here. So I actually, I'm not going to write B, I'm going to write its integral. The integral of B is the integral of D to S, and it's an integral on a 2 surface. So it's D to S, AB, I hope I get this right. I can bring the index downstairs. So this is like, what I mean by this is integral d theta, d phi, and there's an r hat with an index downstairs, so that I pull off a radial vector here. And what it multiplies is EAI, EBJ, ABK, epsilon IJK, and there's an N there. And this is designed in such a way that when I now compute E dot AI at X, which is the Poisson bracket of E with H, what happens is the boundary term, which is the integral of NEE, is canceled by the Poisson bracket of this, which you see by this A, picks up a term in NEE. So I have to have evolution under time of local fields being local, I have to add to the Hamiltonian boundary term. And given the boundary conditions I've discussed, it turns out one has to add this. And you can check that this is now local because of that boundary term. And that's something to check. And if you check that, you'll understand in your bones why there is such a boundary term. Now, here's an interesting statement. The E is falling off to E0. The A is falling off like 1 over R squared. The 2 sphere has an area which is growing like R squared. So this picks up a constant. So now, even though C is 0, H is not equal to 0. H picks up the leading term of the 1 over R squared of A. And again, it would have taken me twice as long at least to motivate the precise fall-off conditions by doing all the checks. But that's why it's very good that E has a zero term, which is just the metric that you're falling off to, and A falls off like 1 over R squared. And in fact, you can check that H is equal to the ADM mass so-called of Arnowitz-Deser and Misner under these fall-off conditions. And in fact, due to the beautiful theorem of Shonan, Yao, and Witten, it's positive definite. And if there's interest, we can do that. I'm not going to do it now, but we can prove that theorem. Because as it happens, Witten's proof is entirely in the language that we're using. This is just a couple of lines, so. So, yes?
So we can establish if we use a partial integration tensor.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I've sort of implied it by saying the look up there, you have a derivative of something. So it implies, had you done the partial integration carefully, it would have been a surface term. So what we learn from this is to distinguish a gauge transformation, which is a evolution forward in time with a sufficiently fast fall off that it doesn't require a boundary term, from a Hamiltonian, which requires a boundary term. So, and this is a subtle distinction, and this is really what I really recommend reading Abai on. And in a certain sense, it's Abai who, I mean, even, you know, modulo the difference between the Ashtakar and the ADM formulation. This was not really, it's in papers from the 1960s, but it's not really crisply and rigorously formulated until some of Abai's papers from the 1970s and early 80s. Okay. Now, you might say, I've cheated. That is, I just at the end told you that the Hamiltonian was a boundary term. But I started with a variational principle. So what I should have done is started at the level of the variational principle, okay, imposed fall-off conditions on the variational principle, and found the necessity of having a boundary term in the variational principle. And let me just sketch that, and then I'll stop. I won't do all the steps, but from what we have, it's not, it's easy to see where that comes from. So the answer, so I didn't have, in other words, I didn't have to do it in this ad hoc way. I could have just gone back to any of the forms of the variational principle that we have. And so let me just consider the variational principle in the form when it was sigma wedge F I plus, so now there's other stuff, there's phi sigma wedge sigma. But notice that this is the only place where there's a derivative. And the analog of this condition in the variational principle is simply that we want the Lagrange, the Euler-Lagrange equations to be local equations. But look at what happens if now I have to worry about a boundary or asymptotic conditions. When I take delta S, delta A, there's a boundary term from here because this is integral sigma wedge D wedge D of AI plus other stuff. And this is the only place in the whole action principle there's a derivative, D delta A. Okay. We integrated that by parts to put it on the sigma. So this became the integral minus, this is the integral on sigma, minus the integral on sigma D sigma wedge delta A plus other stuff. But there really was here a term on the boundary, which is sigma wedge delta A on the boundary. Right? That was really there from doing this from doing the integration by parts. This becomes the local field equation. This eventually becomes, you know, covariant D wedge sigma equals zero, when the other terms just covariantize that. And I'm stuck with this. So I don't have local Euler Lagrange equations because of this boundary term. So what do I have to do? Well, I have to add a boundary term to cancel this off. So I have to add to the action principle a term like integral sigma wedge A. And notice very conveniently, the derivative, this is on space-time, sorry, all of this, what I said is cross R, all of this is a variational principle on the space-time. Okay. So I need a three-form, because the boundary of the four-dimensional space-time is three-dimensional, so I need a three-form, and sigma wedge A is a three-form, okay, traced here. And therefore, if I put this here, I'll get minus the integral on the boundary, sigma cross R, of sigma wedge delta A. So I get to get rid of that against this. So that's good, but then of course I have to worry about minus the integral on the boundary of delta sigma wedge A. And I'm back in trouble again. So what I have to do is introduce a boundary condition that, in addition, sigma at the boundary is some sigma zero, which doesn't vary. And in this form, you see, you don't even have to worry about derivatives, because you just want the delta of sigma to be zero. So you just say sigma at the boundary, whatever it is, however the boundary is defined, okay, is fixed to some sigma zero. So then you have a local variational principle, and you have a boundary term in the action, sigma wedge A, And when you crank through everything, this cranks through to this. I mean, this is, sigma was two E's, so this is, okay, this is basically sigma wedge A. So that's where boundary terms come from. Okay. Questions? Okay, so now this is all with vanishing cosmological constant. What about non-vanishing cosmological constant? And there's a very cool story about non-vanishing cosmological constant boundary conditions, but let's do that next time. And so next time we'll do that, and that will be the issue of the classical theory. I will mention briefly Laurent, Artem, and leave the development of that as a kind of big homework exercise. And then we'll start the final.